ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
ABC Cricket Podcast time with your boys, Corb Middlemass and Ed Cowan for your Monday. Here we are at the end of winter, which means spring is around the corner. You can feel it in the air. And Ed Cowan is here to chop up everything that's going on in the world of cricket with me. Hello, Teddy.
Corby, you must be excited. AFL season's almost done, which means you don't have to work 75 hours a week. You can concentrate on cricket. You can start actually putting some work into the podcast prep.
Please.
We are going to be flying.
There's always plenty of prep into the podcast. You know that, Teddy?
As they say, research isn't a suburb in Melbourne, Corbin.
See, you know all the hits now. You know all the lines. So the mailbag's gone through the roof. So ABC Cricket Podcast at abc.net.au. We will get to that. I think the biggest news in the cricketing world today impacts the upcoming tour of South Africa. Kagiso Rabada, set to miss the series. The 31-year-old suffered a hamstring injury on Sunday, which appears worse than first feared. Cricket South Africa was pretty quick to put out a statement to say, hey, he's been ruled out of the ODIs. We're going to assess the test match in the long run. Little did they know at the time that Alan Donald, who's his domestic bowling coach, was speaking to SA Media Channel News 24, and he essentially said, look, he's out of the test series, so it's a bad hamstring. He's going to miss 10 weeks. So he might have just given up a little bit of the information, but whichever way you chop it up, doesn't look good for the Proteas, Teddy, given they've got the first test around the corner in Durban, the long-awaited return of Australia to South Africa starting on October the 9th.
That is some breaking news. I mean, he would have been causing some night sweats for a top order that has struggled to find its feet in those conditions. Early season, it kind of reeked of Rabada running absolute riot. So they'll be happy for sure. Mm-hmm. It's a good reminder that Australia haven't been back to South Africa since 2018.
It's crazy, isn't it?
Oh, wow. What do you think they're in for?
It's a good, I don't know. I know a lot of people are saying, oh, this is going to be a nightmare and they're tough pitches and everything else and stuff. I feel like they're going to encounter more pitches similar to what they're used to playing on, and that's when Australia plays their best cricket. I feel like I'd almost be more concerned if they were going to play on a bunch of flat wickets somewhere. So first test is Durban, second test in PE, and then the third test is in Cape Town. So there's no Joburg on the schedule. You probably know the area a bit better than me, Teddy. The first one's Durban's pretty humid and it's by the sea, so we'll see what we get there. And Cape Town obviously is the big return. Obviously the first time since the Sandpaper Gate, so it feels like it all builds to the third test. And fingers crossed, promoter's dream would be we get there 1-1.
Yeah, I mean, I think we know what we're in for from a conditions point of view. I was thinking from a hostility, crowd, atmosphere point of view. Like this is something. I mean, it's amazing to think how long it is between tours, and then looking back and the total turnover really of a team and a top order, and the ramifications that had and the flow through. Kind of feels like yesterday, but evidently it wasn't. It's a long time.
A lot of the bowlers are still there. Obviously, Smith's still there, but a couple of the other key protagonists have obviously departed since then. So we'll see how that goes. It's a big test summer for South Africa. When you think about last year, they didn't play a test match. A lot of the grounds have been redeveloped, obviously, in preparation for the 50-over World Cup. But after winning the World Test Championship, they hadn't played a home test match in that next summer. They've got three tests against Australia, two tests against Bangladesh, and then three tests against England over the Christmas period, all essentially before the end of the calendar year. So it's a busy test schedule. The last time that we played test cricket against South Africa was, of course, the World Test Championship final, where Kagiso Rabada took 9. He's got an incredible test record, 340 wickets at just 22. So if he's not there, you think that that immediately helps Australia's chances, or at least it certainly doesn't hurt. Speaking of, Teddy, we're nothing if not a segues game. They're the greatest test cricketers of all time. The top 50 list, I thought, you know what, 340 wickets at 22, maybe that puts you somewhere in and around the best 50 to have ever done it. What's this list all about?
Yeah, that was the segue I was going to use as soon as you rolled that off the tongue. I thought it was a fun game. So I've been lucky enough to be asked by Adam Burnett at cricket.com.au to name the best 50 test cricketers, male, of all time. So they've gone out to, I imagine if I'm included, a whole heap of people have been, you know, given the names of effectively anyone that's played test cricket over the last 150 years. So with the view of releasing the top 50 as voted by whoever for the sesquicentenary test match in March, it's a bloody hard thing to put together. And interestingly, to make sure, you know, you manage your recency bias, you have to include three players from every era.
Ooh.
As defined, I think, by a decade.
Okay.
And so you can't chalk your 50 with modern greats. You got to look back in time and think, oh, Sid Barnes better than Warwick Armstrong? Or, you know, so there's some thoughts around how you go about it. So I don't know, how would you do it? Because statistics, you got to look through statistics.
Yep.
But in my mind, there's like 25 locks. The greats of the last 50, 60 years have to be there. And then you kind of, do you go for impact on the game? You know, WG Grace, stats didn't really cut it, but, you know, played right at the end of his career, but had a massive impact on the game. Does that include him? I suppose it's not most influential test cricketers. It's best. But would he, or what about Graham Pollock or, you know, Barry Richards? How do you think about those players, considering how little they played during that period, but by all accounts, you know, probably should be there?
Do you think Zimbabwe or Bangladesh, any of those nations produced top 50 cricketer of all time?
I think Andy Flower would probably make a case.
Okay. Shakib?
Perhaps.
Yeah.
But so, neither in the 25 locks, but you know, so, Andy Flower's numbers would stack up to anyone's.
Okay. So maybe put those guys as, you know, a couple here or there. Basically, essentially, I was going to say I'd go through the top nine nations and I would probably work through who are their top 5 to 10 greatest cricketers of all time as a starting point. So then you can kind of compare across countries. But I feel like if you can't force your way into the top 10 in your country, it's pretty hard to try and make the case that, you know, the 15th best cricketer or whatever or the 20th best cricketer in England or Australia qualifies in the top 50.
So that's a good methodology.
Yep.
Now name the top 10 Australian test cricketers of all time.
Yeah.
Exactly.
It's easy, like you said, it's easy to name the first 5 or 6. It's then when we're splitting hairs, 7th versus 16th is probably much harder. Yeah. Mm.
Okay. Anyway, something to watch. It's a fun game. I'm happy to take suggestions if people, more from a methodology point of view, and then, you know, we can kind of go through it. Anyway, it's a great idea. Hats off to the cricket.com.au team for getting this done. And
you leaning on any historians for the yesteryear type stuff?
Interesting. You think I should get out the black book and
maybe.
Who would you lean upon? Gideon.
Yeah. Jim Maxwell's probably commentated most of them as well, so he'd have
a
pretty good recall. Rick Finlay will be able to give you some good data.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a few
resources. We need a team. We need a team and a workshop.
I like it. Session. Are you going to be able to give us your list as we work our way through?
Yeah, absolutely.
Beautiful. Can't wait. So keep an eye out for that. When will it come out? In time for the sesquicentenary?
I think the day before the test match. Big reveal.
Can I have a third go at that? Sesquicentennial. Test match. Wasn't happy with the first two. All right. I'll look forward to that. I'll look forward to that. And, of course, you can hear that match right here on ABC Sport. Where do you want to get? Do you want to go to test match cricket in England? So test at Lord's, which England ended up winning handsomely. So they win a test series for the first time since December 2024. It's been almost 2 years since they saluted in a test series. I would say it's a good start for Stephen Fleming, only for the fact he wasn't there. There in caretaker mode, it was a win by 194 runs for England. So 2-0 series victory. Ollie Robinson with 4 for 11 and 4 for 24, the man of the match. There was a number of talking points out of this game. Should we start with the pitch? It was obviously a game which was heavily impacted by rain, but I saw Emilio Gay's dismissal where it was out for 31, a ball which felt like it went underground. It sort of hit the deck and shot through was absolutely unplayable. And day three, in which produced less than 25 overs, Teddy, drew 24%, I think was the quote from Ben Jones, of false shots, which is incredible. So nearly one in every four shots a batsman is playing was a false shot. There's been a lot of criticism of the pitch at Lord's for various reasons, but this didn't help quieten down any of that. They've already lost the World Test Championship final, and not a pretty deck for these guys to try and combat.
Yeah, and this is a pretty consistent trend line. I mean, many moons ago now, if you go about what was Lord's known for, aside, you know, putting the slope aside and the natural variation that comes with that, it was always, you know, a hard pitch, as in it was firm. It had good bounce. It was never the bounciest, but it was a consistent bounce, and it often turned. And I have no idea why this is the case. I'm no agriculturalist. But something has happened to the clay and the grass in that wicket that is producing inconsistent bounce and slow. I always look to the first few overs of a test match. You turn, you get the excitement. When you see a ball bounce twice, mm-hmm. and it didn't in this test match, the ball was zipping through, it was badly overcast. But if you think it through to that World Test Championship last year and the test, the home test before that, balls were bouncing twice before going to the keeper on the first day of a test match. That is a really bad sign. And so where it kind of gets to is, you know, you need new eyes on that. And ultimately it probably leads to a digging up of the square. Like, it's a long way back. And so the SCG had this problem, but has now had to go the other way to cover up for whatever issues are going on inside the clay and the grass. Have had to juice it up, and I'm unsure that's the answer as well. So,
yeah, is there a chance it's overuse? Like, you think about how much cricket is played on at Lord's every year, like way more than our major grounds. I mean, obviously we can't even get our first class cricket on our major grounds at the moment, but that they, I think they estimate on average it's about 15 to 20 days of sort of major cricket a year. Yeah. But on top of that, they reckon there's about 40 to 55 days of cricket because...
And easily.
Maybe this
Eton
comes...
play, yep. Bugalugs, Oxford play, Cambridge, you have the... And historically, you know, you'd use the nursery ground at the back, but that's pretty much no longer.
And
you've
got to
remember there are so many wickets. So I think that's an easy kind of analysis. There are so many wickets, and the test strip itself, you know, the two in the centre, they're not getting much use. They're set aside at the start of the season. So, yes, on the – and maybe, you know, it's easy to say, you know, actual use, but if you're playing four wickets over, then, you know, if you're standing at point, you're standing on the middle of
– Yeah.
Middle of the wicket. So, of the test strip. So I get that to a degree and maybe, but I'm unsure. It feels like there's something a bit more structural than that.
Right. It's something they've got to address. I mean, they've already started to lose things, being the World Test Championship final, as mentioned. So that wasn't
but
a
they
great...
have full control. The MCC have full control over that ground. So there's no reason why. It's not as though, you know, it's not like the SCG. You're dealing with the Swans. There are different stakeholders that gets owned by the government. This is, if they want to get that right, the MCC can make that happen. They're not broke. And so I'd implore them to think long and hard about it.
There was another controversial moment too, where Imam El Haq had a calf injury, was unable to bat in the first innings. It was first reported as a strain. It was later reported as a grade one tear. Former selector Muhammad Wasim accused him of faking the injury. So there was more controversy around this. What has happened to Pakistan cricket? Like, it felt like it wasn't that long ago that if you squint, you thought, gee, this is a team that can win like a major trophy. They were playing some electric cricket, not just with the white ball, but in the test arena. They had, you know, a full battery of young fast bowlers coming through. Yeah, Babar Azam looked like he was in the conversation for the best batsman in the world. And now they're hopeless. You know, lost to Bangladesh, cannot get anything going whatsoever. It's a really sad decline to see where they're at the moment.
Total quagmire. And not close enough to it, but you get a sense, you know, the politicking in the background doesn't help. How the instability of coaching staff, the ins and the outs. And I always do think, and it's like most cricket teams, but it probably is more evident with Pakistan, their fielding is a massive bellwether for the rest of their cricket. And you know, if you look across these two tests, there was a great catch taken in the slips. But apart from that, they were dropping catches, misfielding, fall, tripping over themselves. Like, their general athleticism has actually gone backwards. And, you know, that speaks volumes about a whole range of these guys are super athletic, talented cricketers, and yet that's their attitude to the only thing that you do as a team. It's kind of mind-blowing. I thought the two issues to come out of the test match that you were going to pitch, one was cricket-related. As soon as Brendan McCullum is no longer the coach, they go back to a military medium pacer who just kind of owns the towel. You know, this whole the need for speed, to go to the Ashes, we need guys who bowl fast, blah, 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 blah. Actually, in England, you just need the guy who just rolls his arm over and hits the towel and moves the ball a little bit each way. Hello, Ollie Robinson.
I thought you were going to say it was another win for Sydney grade cricket. Just
Sydney University Cricket Club, And so just fascinating to see how different philosophies can actually impact outcomes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And the other one was obviously Imran Khan interview. His son's being interviewed, and then the PCB threatening to not take the field.
Probably says everything. You know, it's no wonder the cricket is how it is on the field at the moment. But it's a, it's a sharp decline. It feels like it wasn't even that long ago. Like when Ramiz Raja was in charge, and I think it was not long after that, as I was talking about all that optimism, they'd appointed Jason Gillespie to come in and take over the red ball setup. They had Gary Kirsten there with the white ball. And it never got off the ground. I don't even think Gary Kirsten coached a game. They came out here in 2020, I think it was the World Cup, 2022, and Dizzy picked up the white ball at the last minute. It all ended in tears, obviously, on that front, and they have never been able to get any kind of momentum or build anything from there. But it feels like it's as low as it has been on field for almost in my time following Pakistan cricket, the way that it is at the moment.
And world cricket needs
a
strong Pakistan.
Yeah,
For a whole range of reasons, to provide a counterbalance to other teams in the region, aside from anything else. But the weaker, we're talking about a huge cricketing population.
Massive.
There's no shortage of talent, no shortage of interest, and yet that's their national team.
Awesome.
And so it comes down to systems and structures and incentives and how that kind of flows through the system.
Goes a bit beyond too, I think, the relationship with India, doesn't it? I feel like in this part of the world, often the analysis of Pakistan cricket centres around, India frees them out of the IPL and they freeze them out of this and whatever it turns out to be in the cricketing world. That they are issues that they've had to juggle for two decades, and it hasn't quite been as poor as it is at the moment. Sri Lanka and India. So did you follow much of the first test here? And our man Yashas Vijayaswal found himself in a little situation with Sitha Fernando. In the end, both guys. So Yashas V appeared to just nod his head towards Fernando, who had seemingly given him some kind of a send-off, or at least somebody had. They were in an altercation after he was dismissed. And the appropriate penalty here, Teddy, is that both guys were fined 25% of their match fee for one guy laying the headbutt with a helmet and the other guy receiving it.
I did see that. What are you insinuating, Corb?
You
think it's an unfair penalty?
It was an interesting episode. It was
when someone gets fined for receiving a headbutt. Do you think there's something more sinister?
I thought the whole episode to basically say, hey, 25% of your match fee for both guys is very in keeping with everything we've seen with the ICC over a period of time, hasn't it? Yeah, Virat Kohli laying a shepherd in the middle of the MCG on Boxing Day, and just makes you shake your head a little bit. It was a pretty dull draw in the end, wasn't it?
It was a very dull draw. That's why I wasn't paying all that much attention.
Fair enough, too. Just a battle.
Been busy watching the European Super
League. Yeah, I was going to say, I knew you were busting to talk about this. What do you make of all this? I know you're a little bit of a skeptic to start with.
Well, now that's up. So having played a lot of cricket in a few of these parts, and I don't love the word associate nation, but effectively non-test playing cricket nations. And they are vibrant cricket communities. It's amazing what a little bit of money can do. Like the marquee player that is turning up to this league is second to none outside the big leagues of SA, America, Australia and England. So like if you're the...
So where's the money coming from?
Private money.
Right.
And so it's kind of weird seeing Glenn Maxwell play for the Belfast Wolves, whatever they're called.
Yeah, the Wolves. Yeah, you're all over it.
Oh, yeah. With CDC on his chest. So business formerly known as Canberra Data Centres. That's the same team that sponsors the Canberra Raiders, associated with Greg Borah, who's an owner of the team. You know, so there are lots of people who love cricket who are investing in this league to try and make it work. And Steve Smith's turning up next week, and you've got some, you know, Ravi Ashwin's playing. There are some big names there. Ultimately, how do these teams make money? There's only one determining factor, and that's TV rights. And so while I admire the courage of people to try and grow the game, but also to align incentives to create a viable product from a whole range of reasons, including their own incentive to make money, I just can't see the end point here. Maybe. And so there are five local players have to play in each team. Is that good or bad? You know, you can have the argument, well, that's great for the local ecosystem. That's bad for the investors. You'd want 11 internationals to be able to put on the highest quality tournament you can. And so it's kind of interesting to see where this leads. My gut feel is it's good cricket, but it fizzles.
Right.
People aren't willing to lose money for long periods of time.
All right. It's interesting watch on that front. I mean, how does it differ from MLC?
I think the prize is bigger. So the MLC prize, if you've kind of fast forward over 20 years, the Asian diaspora in the US is growing. There's more money. And so do people in Rotterdam really care about anything but soccer? No. And so I just think there's a bit more white space. There's a little bit more of a natural support base. I'm not saying that I'm supportive. I think it's good for these countries, but ultimately I'm unsure where it lands.
Yep. It's interesting because you have been supportive of the MLC in the past, where I'll look at them both and I go, both non-traditional backgrounds, both reliant very much on people from cricketing heartlands trying to support it and take it up. You could actually make the case with some of the teams that are represented there, like you talk about the Netherlands, who we've seen in major tournaments, Ireland obviously have test status, that there's actually more of an inbuilt cricketing background or they're more advanced, certainly on a national level as a cricketing team, than what the US is. And yet we're talking about the US like it could be the second best league behind the IPL. And we're talking about this startup in Europe as if, it's almost not worth the squeeze.
I think you're probably a little bit absolute in both those terms. I'd say the MLC is exciting and, you're talking about the biggest sports ecosystem in the world.
Yep.
And I'm on a bit of a, I'm excited for the Euro teams, but I'm just on a bit of a watch as to see what it looks like on a five-year basis, because ultimately you're going to need localised support.
We might just go through the rosters, Teddy, because as you said, there are some names here. So,
big time.
The Amsterdam Flames are the team representing the Netherlands. So you got all the guys that we're used to seeing, obviously, from that.
I think there are two Dutch teams. Is there a Rotterdam team as well?
You're right. Sorry, there are. So we've seen some of the name brand Netherlands guys. Scott Edwards has obviously played down here in Melbourne. Max O'Dowd and Bas de Leyte are all part of this team. But the big internationals. So Tim David's playing there. Ajinkya Rahane, who's obviously recently retired. So you get a big Indian name. Steve Smith, Mitch Marsh, Michael Bracewell, the Kiwis down there, all on this lineup. And David Payne, who I know you're a big fan of. The other Rotterdam team, the other Dutch team is Rotterdam, who are called the Dockers, by the way. I don't know how many Dockers we've got in.
That's a good name.
Isn't it? We don't have too many Dockers in other sports around the world. Faf du Plessis there as the captain. They've also got Henrik Claassen, obviously the South African. Ben McDermott's playing. Who are some other names that are worth shouting out here? Henrik Norkia. Yeah. So he's playing there, and Ben Menenti also as an Australian on that Rotterdam team. The Belfast Wolves. So this team includes Devon Conway, David Miller, Glenn Maxwell, who you've shouted out already.
These are big names. Like, these are household international T20 names.
Chris Jordan also plays for Belfast.
Imagine if some of these names turned up into the Big Bash.
Yeah. Should I go through the other three squads or we just get a message?
We got the message.
You can check it out in your own time. But as you said, there's some big names. Little county cricket check, by the way. Did you see Ryan Campbell's tweets as the coach of Durham? So,
what happened?
They're top of Division 2 at the moment. They were cruising towards a victory over Gloucestershire, who were all out for 250 on day three. The target in the fourth innings of the match was 4. But it was 6:20 at night and the umpire said it was too dark.
No!
And there was poor weather forecast on day 4. Did not allow them the chance to go out at 6:20 at night, which, as you know, in Europe at this time of the year is not 6:20 at night here in the middle of winter. They did get on the next day, you'll be pleased to know, and Matthew Potts was hit for a boundary off the last ball of the first over, and that was it. Came back for 6 balls.
I mean, it takes a certain type to want to be an umpire. We know that. And the black letter of the law suggested that, you know, it was too dangerous.
So Cambo's thing was basically don't blame the umpires, blame the rules and the laws and the stupidness of it. I guess why maybe I worded that the wrong way, Teddy, is that, of course, Matthew Potts is the fast bowler, and yet he was opening the batting with...
I'm so confused.
And
that's right.
If that didn't confuse you enough, he opened the batting with a guy named Ollie Robinson, who's the keeper batsman... Not the Ollie Robinson who started the test match. So complete different Ollie Robinson. But there's another piece of confusion from county cricket. There's always something going on, isn't there, in county cricket? There's so many games and there's weirdness happening all over the place. Should we do some listener emails?
Absolutely.
Let's do it. Okay. We had lots of listener emails over the last week, obviously, given the Bangladesh series was on. We didn't have a chance to get to all of them, and we won't on this occasion, but please keep sending them through. We'd love to hear from you, and maybe your email will be heard right here on the show. So that's abccricketpodcast@abc.net.au. So first of all, shout-outs to Keith, to Gus, to Tim, Sean, Ed, Peter, Simon, Sam, Cam, and Roger. Appreciate all your contributions and emails. Keep them coming through, and we will get to as many of them as we can.
Hang on, is that your shorthand for thanks for sending, but we're not reading it out?
The first of our emails, Cameron, on the subject of Bryden Cass being de-arrested, is this an example of DRS technology where Cass has appealed the decision to the police?
Hang on. So those poor people who didn't get theirs read out.
Well, you can only imagine.
You've reached for this as the.
You can only imagine what some of those were, Teddy. So.
I'm
abdicating all responsibility. I don't go through the emails, and as you can tell by the way I read some of these, a lot of the times I'm reading them for the first time as we're here recording this pod.
I'll tell you what would also be nice.
Yeah.
We have a lot of female listeners.
We do.
We just read out a lot of male names. I'd like the sometimes, you know, we should strive for some equality here as well, Corb.
Always. Yeah. There's
I don't know if your hand are only the.
I think you think that I actually go through all this, Teddy, which a lot of the time it's handed to me and away we go.
So okay. I forget you're just the talent. You know, you're no longer that mailman. You're not the mailbag guy as well these days.
Tom says, I'm planning my dream holiday next year, spending 2 months in the UK. I want to go to at least one day of each Ashes test.
Oh, yes.
Is it risky if I don't make it to day one or two?
No. I think if you bought day three tickets to every test match, you're safe in England.
Okay. I agree with that.
I thought it was.
You wanted some holiday tips.
Can you start planning my itinerary? I mean, if Tom wants some holiday work and where, you know, the little villages along the way, I'm open to that as well. I love a little bit of holiday planning.
After a series draw, what can you tell us about Bangladesh's coach Phil Simmons and how he goes about it from David?
Well, evidently he has instilled some basic principles of good test cricket into his team. And he spoke a little bit about this during the series of, you know, protecting your wicket, making bowlers come back for second, third, fourth spells. And we saw this very much in the first test. The second was probably an aberration. They got outskilled. But when they got an opportunity, you know, the discipline to which they took with the ball, there was nothing fancy, there was nothing funky. They just bowled with excellent discipline. and their batters applied themselves. And so I think with those basic principles, he's actually found a method that can, you know, really push the, you know, the top teams for long periods of time. Because I think they've worked out the way the modern game's going, you can have a kind of counter thesis, which is the longer a test match goes, the more chance the lower ranked team is. If it's, and historically it'd probably been the other way around, you know, toss the coin. If a wicket's a bit spicy, maybe we get knocked over.
Yeah.
But I think they're leaning into the other view, which is they're going to play the game in fast forward. And so if we can take a breath and actually try and absorb some pressure, they're not going to change their philosophy. And so there's a little chink in the armor that they otherwise couldn't have exposed. It was interesting, his comments, I think, after the first day in Mackay, and I think it was Kerry O'Keefe was relaying this. He passed him and said, "Oh, well done on the last test. You know, it was great to see." And he said, "Well, that means nothing. We've been hopeless today."
Mm.
And so it's someone who is, you know, used to winning and being part of that team and that was so successful in the West Indies, and he's trying to bring a little bit of that to Bangladesh cricket and fair dues to him.
Yeah, absolutely. Certainly in Darwin we saw it, didn't it? There was that clear cause and effect between, hey, this is the plan for each session, this is the way we're going to play, and they carried it out. They were certainly the more disciplined team there. He's had a long coaching history now too, yes, hasn't he? So if you think about, he's been the Bangladesh coach since 2024. He coached the West Indies across two different terms, 2015, 2016, and then again between 2019 and 2022. Won a World Cup in that time in 2016. He's also been the head coach for Zimbabwe, for Ireland, for Afghanistan, and was a specialist and consultant coach for Papua New Guinea way back in 2014. Plus a bunch of franchise sides along the way.
He likes the hard jobs. There's no freebies in that resume, which is, it speaks to, you know, it feels like there's some missionary element to his work of upskilling, you know, cricketers and cricket teams in, you know, that are underdogs.
The next of our emails, Wade in Townsville, this was after the Darwin loss, said, "Is there a problem with players today refusing to be coached?" So talk about the cause and effect there between what we saw from Bangladesh and the way they went about it.
Yeah, it's interesting. So how would I would say people are more reliant on their own private little bubble of coaches and mentors and then come together as opposed to, and so now that there's more money in the game and players are playing for longer, there's more incentive for players, there's also an incentive for private coaching.
Yep. Do you think that exists in cricket more than other sports? Like,
yeah,
it's interesting, right? Like, I always observe in cricket, maybe because of the pace of the game and how technical it is and everything, but like before the start of play, you'll often see like greats of the game who are out there commentating walk out on the ground and start chatting to players about techniques and various other things. You think, in all the times I've done footy, or in all the times the players are out there, I never remember some great of the game going out there and thought, "Hey, mate, have you thought running to this position or doing that?" Like, whereas in cricket, it's almost like unsolicited advice is everywhere. Like, it's so prevalent.
Yeah, well, I mean, everyone's a tinkerer when it comes to cricket technique. There are so many different ways to do it, and everyone has a variety of opinions. But I think it does make the role of these specialist team coaches, you know, the batting coach, the bowling coach, are pretty confined to the impact that they can have. You know, across formats, we've got different coaches with different techniques across formats. You know, with that player accountability probably comes lesser impact from the coaching group. And that's, I think, a bad thing. I think the younger players become more accustomed to it and so they stop listening. You know, historically you had a team coach and that was it. And as you move teams, that was the voice you listened to. But sometimes too many voices it's pretty hard.
No doubt. And then you talk about the past players and the past greats. It's hard when one of them comes forward and says, "Hey, you should do this." And then if you don't take on the advice, what happens then? What if the advice contradicts what either your personal coach or your batting coach is telling you at that particular stage? So
yeah,
surely we got to get back to a stage though, don't we, where if you're playing in the national team, we should expect that you have the very best coaching available. Like we have that healthy competitive arrogance about us, surely, as a country, where we think that whether we want to be the number one team in the world, it's where Australia has resided for the better part of 50 years. So we should have the best access to coaches, the best people in those positions, and that should be the primary voice that our cricketers should be listening to.
Yeah, I mean, so I agree, but if you think that Ricky, the T20 incentive structures are wrong, Ricky Ponting is probably the best batting coach in the world. Let's say he's a commentator in Australia. He doesn't coach all the Australian players. If you're an Australian player, would you gravitate and ask him what he thinks, even though he's not your coach? But there's no incentive for him to be the Australian coach. And so it is a pretty interesting dynamic.
Mm. Craig says, I have a theory on the current selection panel. George Bailey, Andrew McDonald, Tony Dottomade.
We love theories.
They were all players that were on the edge of selection when they were representing Australia. You could argue at different times there was obviously
George captain Australia.
Absolutely. And in the white balls, he was absolutely a mainstay. I'm wondering if they carry the mindset of thinking they deserved more chances into their selection thoughts and give players a longer run than perhaps they deserve. P.S. I was at the Sydney live show last year and want to see more of it this summer.
We're all in on the live shows. Great. It's not a bad theory. I mean, I think the longer you stay, I think George's perspective is probably more shaped from his time as a captain more than a fringe player. I mean, he wasn't a fringe player in one day international cricket.
No.
But as a captain, you like stability. You like being able to bring people through and encourage people and give them a bit more of a go. So I think that would probably and you could say the same for Andrew McDonald. I think the longer you're around cricket and the older you get, you do understand the ebbs and flows of the game a bit more, and you're a little less cutthroat of he's good enough or he's not good enough, because your own journey has probably helped shape that view. I think what they were faced with was a selection panel. You inherit a team and some generational players, and it takes a lot of courage to move people on who then have a voice and a profile and et cetera, et cetera.
I think there's a big, and this is probably more at the feet of Todd Greenberg and the board, that there's a big fear, isn't there, that there's going to be a huge exodus at some point, that all these guys are going to exit at the same time, and the selection panel and the coach are going to be tied to that. That essentially all the guys will depart around a similar point, and then Andrew McDonald will say, "Oh, that's it, I've had enough too," and then George Bailey and everyone else is tied to that and decides to move on. That is surely something that the game, as in cricket, has to ensure that doesn't happen. Whether to make sure that this crew that we've got at the moment sees through the incoming of the next generation, that it's not as if, you know, all of a sudden someone else comes in and they've got to rebuild it all when, nothing's been put in place and there's no, long-term horizons. No one's been looking out for those over a period of time. So surely that's on Greenberg, isn't it, to make sure that these guys are signed up for the long-term, if they're going to do it now, to stay there, long past the champions depart.
Yeah, it's a good call out. It is, but I don't, there's little incentive, as we've talked about before, for people to look beyond their own contract and people have their own lives. So some planning and understanding what that rotation would look like, and these guys like working together and they will be tied to each other. I can only imagine, if Andrew McDonald decides not to be coach, I imagine the selection panel dissolves as well. Or, Pat isn't captain. Like, there are...
Well, then they need to change that now, then. They need to get someone in there that they know is going to be there for the next 5 years, whether that's adding a fourth member, whatever it turns out to basically say, hey, we can't afford that this all ends at the same time. So maybe that's something. I mean, this isn't going to be a thing where all of a sudden they all walk away and we go, oh, we didn't know it was going to happen. Like, they know what's going to happen, or at least there's a huge fear that might unfold in that particular fashion. So start putting some provisions in now, because that is the role of the governing body, isn't it, to look out for what's happening years in advance. As you said, I understand those guys. You think these are the people we like working with. This is what we're trying to do, and we'll jump out when we want to jump out.
Yeah. Well said.
Travis in Maryborough, with the slim pickings for batters in the Shield competition of late, do we have to be fined with players averaging in the low 30s being picked in the test team?
Emotionally, for sure. I mean, unless proven otherwise, no one is averaging 50 plus. So that's how it's working. Interestingly, did you see the news this week around the decree from Cricket Australia around tipping the balance back to the batters a little bit more in short cricket?
Yep, there's going to be the second session is going to be longer, and the pitches are going to be told to err on the side of the batsman.
So excuses are out, runs are in.
Perfect. Glenn in Beijing, love the pod. The great. Only contact with cricket from China. He umpired the China Cup between Beijing and Shanghai. Beijing won by 4 wickets, and because it had rained in the lead-up, there was a wet patch at mid-wicket, so if the ball went there, it was called a dead ball. Mm-hmm. There you go.
Interesting.
Shout-out to Glenn.
I think Ali De Winter is coaching in China.
He is. I saw something like that on one of his social media platforms the other day. Yeah. Shout-out to Ali.
Great human.
Jed says, if the purpose of the Bangladesh series was to tune up for the bigger ones coming up, why didn't we bat first in Mackay after the display in Darwin? It would have given our batters 2 opportunities and the selectors double the evidence to judge on.
Well, losing 2-0 to Bangladesh was not an option. So I think they tried that and it backfired.
Correct.
And if they'd won that test match, I think if Australia was 1-0 up, they would have batted in Mackay.
Scotty from the Gold Coast.
Do you agree with that?
No doubt. Once we got to Mackay, it was, hey, let's just, that was the most predictable thing of all time, wasn't it? We got the test in Mackay that we thought we were going to get in Darwin, where it was, let's just get out of here with the win. And unfortunately, style points were out after the loss in Darwin.
Style points were out. That's a good line.
Scotty from the Gold Coast, given the Darwin test will always be hot and humid in the future, we should play New Zealand or England or Iceland there. Instead of the subcontinent teams who are used to the conditions, from Scotty.
As I said, let's play 2 tests against England in winter and Bangladesh can have the main summer for 5.
John in Canberra loves the winter test cricket. He's an avid rugby union and NRL fan, but this filled his cricket craving. So there you go, more support for cricket in Australia in this time of the year.
Excellent commentary, agree.
Paul says, love the pod, best cricket analysis in the country. If a possible solution to our declining shield quality is making the test players play. That way, in the next generation, are tested against the best in the country more regularly. I remember as a low-grade Sydney uni player, it was amazing when Matthews, McGill, Clark, Cowan, Phelps, Mayle, Casson would all come back. Grassroots cricket heaven, from Paul.
Why make them play shield cricket when they can be drinking schooners at Old Mates in New York? I mean, we don't pay them to play cricket, do we?
Let's get it back to a full round or 2 full rounds before the test starts. Let's just start there rather than all of it all the time. How good would it be if we had a Friday to Monday round or whatever it turned out to be, and all your major guys were there? What a treat
Couldn't agree with you more.
Preparation in the lead up.
It doesn't. And to be fair, I'll take my slightly cynical hat off. When the workloads are needed to be there, there are times, where the fast bowlers do turn up. It's just, it is hard in the, if you think about Hazelwood last year, I think he played 2 games. Stark played 2. Cummins played 2 and they were available for 3. So they weren't, leading into the Ashes, I think there was definitely a push.
Did anyone from New South Wales ask Steve Smith to play at the back end of last year? Or was it just assumed that he wasn't going to play?
I'll let you assume.
Okay. When Ed used to practice in the nets, were the pitches generally flat or a bit green to mimic test wickets, from Travis?
Well, it depends. I mean, the joy, of practice wickets is they try and get some longevity out of them. And so they would always, you'd have a 2-week cycle and the first 4 days were treacherous and the last 2 days were treacherous and everything in between was great. So you've got a variety of conditions and you when the new balls were flying around on wet wickets, you learn how to not get out or not get hit or both.
Last one today, Declan from Northern New South Wales. Love the punter story. I have my own of sorts. I was flying home from Sydney and got moved to the front row of this tiny flight. And the last person to walk on and sit next to me was my childhood hero, Gilly. I almost went into shock. As we were settling in for the flight, my mind was racing with questions, mentioning that I'd had workshops with his dad, Stan, and how to play it cool. I think about 30 seconds after we got onto the flight, I turned to him and said hello, and he was fast asleep and napped all the way through to when we landed. In retrospect, probably a good thing that I let him sleep. He clearly needed it from Declan. How good's that? Oh, that's cool. It was popular, wasn't it? Your story.
I don't know. You tell me.
I think that it was. It was. One of the most feedback I got was I think the drilling noises made it as you really added to the story. So, hats off to you, Teddy. Good hit out as always. We'll do it again next week, as we do every Monday right here on the ABC Cricket Podcast. Have a good week, Teddy.
Thanks, Corb. You too.